we have to be very, very careful. What we're talking is not so much democracy, we're talking organised hypocrisy. Hard facts.
The result of the Dutch national election just passed will have met with a sigh of relief in Brussels, home to the European Union. The fact that the extreme right candidate in that election, Geert Wilders, was defeated, despite being neck and neck in the polls with his centre-right opponent Mark Rutte going into the election, allows us to ponder if this result marks a pushback against the centrifugal anti-immigrant and anti-EU forces of right-wing populism that have been on the march across Europe these past few years. Of all the countries that make up the European Union, the Netherlands, or Holland as it is commonly referred to, carries, or at least used to carry, a proud tradition of liberalism, tolerance, and sanctuary for those suffering religious and political persecution. Perhaps the most famous example of this tradition concerns the life of the pre-Enlightenment 17th century philosopher Baruch Spinoza, a Jew of Spanish origin whose parents relocated to Amsterdam from Portugal, attracted by the country's tolerance of the Jews and the Jewish faith, unlike Portugal at that time. However, in recent times, the Netherlands has not escaped the ill winds of anti-globalisation that have blown across the European continent that suffered the ravages of the global economic crash of 2008, a crisis to which the liberal and centrist status quo had no answers other than the implementation of austerity, tantamount to punishing working people and the poor for the economic mismanagement of the rich, particularly the banking and financial sector. On the back of the ensuing economic hardship caused by austerity, of which the Dutch government, led by the aforementioned Mark Rutte, has been a particularly staunch advocate, we have seen a generational rise of the populist and far right, with a politics of anti-immigration, xenophobia and intolerance for the other. In many ways, the traction of right-wing nostrums on immigration, multiculturalism and liberalism we are witnessing today echoes the 1930s, when in similar conditions of economic recession and dislocation, the liberal order back then also collapsed, giving way to the far right. But now, on the back of the defeat of the right in the Netherlands, has this tide of right-wing populism crashed on the rocks of its own historical legacy? And what of Brussels in the EU? With the French elections imminent, where Marine Le Pen of the French National Front is currently high in the polls, will the Dutch election result have a bearing there? Perhaps indeed, Dutch voters have themselves been influenced by events in the UK, where Brexit has pushed the country into a political and constitutional crisis that grows ever deeper with each passing week. As the Irish poet W.B. Yeats reminds us in his classic work The Second Coming, things fall apart, the centre cannot hold, mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, the blood-dimmed tide is loosed and everywhere, the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. I'm John White, and this is Hard Facts. Well, joining me to pick through these matters, I'm delighted to be joined by Kees van der Peel. Mr. Peel is a Professor Emeritus at the School of Global Studies at the University of Sussex. Kees, welcome to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Perhaps you could, if you like, outline the significance of this Dutch election result. Starting with events in the Netherlands itself, we've seen Geert Wilders was riding high in the polls. Many were picking him to win the election, but his party did gain seats despite the fact that they ultimately went down to defeat. What is the significance of this election and what are its ramifications for Holland?
Well, don't forget that, as you rightly say, Wilders was riding high in the polls, and everyone expected, let us say 3 months ago, that he would end up as the largest party in the country. But we shouldn't forget that the themes that he has campaigned on in earlier elections, not this time so much, because this time he was pretty much absent from the campaign, but the themes that he has campaigned on have been adopted, unfortunately, by the mainstream parties, especially by the mainstream Liberal Party of Prime Minister Rutte and by the Christian Democratic Party. And that means that his Wilders appeal has been hollowed out, also because the demands that he actually raised in this election campaign, like an interdiction of the Quran and the closing down of mosques, were completely unrealistic. So you really had to be pretty stupid or pretty angry or both to still cling to to Wilders. Now, the really decisive event, I would say, that proved that Rutte and his party were claiming the mantle of anti-foreigner rhetoric was the incident in Rotterdam, where after the Dutch had forbidden the Turkish minister of foreign affairs to land here, they let the Turkish minister of family affairs, Mrs. Kaya, through to Rotterdam first, and then in front of the camera, she was told to go back by the police to Germany. So she was expelled from the country. Rutte then appeared on TV to explain that this was his hard line. And it's very interesting to see that in the final debate with Wilders, the two-man debate between Rutte and Wilders, Wilders was lost for words because Rutte effectively had taken over his program. So when people can choose between, let's say, the decent authoritarian and the maverick authoritarian, they will always go for the decent one. And that is, if you ask me, why Rutte spectacularly turned the tables and effectively defeated Wilders. So there is an element of what I would say provocation involved, because don't forget that what has happened in Rotterdam, there were very ugly demonstrations, and you know the police had to intervene very forcefully. This has left a very ugly legacy, and the person who will be Dutch Minister of Foreign Affairs will have a very tough job trying to repair the damage that has been done to relations with Turkey.
Well, it's created a full-scale diplomatic row with Turkey.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Indeed, it's created a diplomatic row between the EU and Turkey, especially with Turkey for many, many years coveting membership of the EU, now looks like a forlorn hope. So what you're saying effectively is Mark Rutte very opportunistically adopted the far-right nostrums on anti-immigration and Islamophobia that Geert Wilders is known for and renowned for. That's the basis on which he was elected. That's actually a very worrying development. Where is the left in the Netherlands today? I mean, I did mention in my introduction that Holland has traditionally been seen as a repository of liberal, progressive ideas going back many, many centuries. It's all ended. It's shifted markedly to the right. Now, obviously, we're going to get into the global aspects to this and the whys and wherefores, but where is the left in Holland? Is there an active left, a cohesive left, that's able to push back in any way against this rising tide of right-wing populism?
Well, if you permit me, let me first say that the tradition of tolerance that Holland was famed for was really not so much based on a real interest in people from abroad. It was an indifference, and that has always been the case. Spinoza, whom you mentioned, was a renowned figure. But in Holland, he was not treated very well.
No, he was excommunicated ultimately from the Jewish faith in Holland, wasn't he? Yeah.
He was also persecuted by the Dutch Reformed Church because they didn't like his insights.
Anti-clericalism,
et cetera.
Yeah, okay.
But coming back to the present, don't forget that the most dramatic outcome of the election is not that Rutte, through what I would say is an opportunistic appropriation of the themes of Wilders and culminating in a provocative operation which smacks of a political theater. But the real dramatic outcome was the defeat of the historic party of Labour, the mainstream Labour Party in the Netherlands, the Partij van de Arbeid. They went down from somewhere in the 30s seats to 9, and that's the greatest defeat in their history. So basically they're now the 6th or 7th party in size. And that is because people feel very, well, more than disappointed. They feel fooled by a party that calls itself the Party of Labour and in fact has sided with Rutte in applying a very harsh austerity. Of course, it's austerity with a smile. It's Dutch style, you know. It's always presented as innocent adjustments, etc. But the poorest layers of society have really taken a beating, and not just they. Also the whole infrastructure of the welfare state, but also cultural politics, for instance, have been bled white. in ways that you wouldn't believe. That there are composers now in Holland and people who write for theatre who have publicly declared that they will no longer write their stuff out of protest against this sort of policy. Now, the Liberal Party, of course, also has lost, the mainstream Liberal Party, but you might say it's its natural program that it's executing. It was always a right-wing Liberal Party. But for the Labour Party, it's pure, well, treason, you know, there's no other word for it. They have betrayed their followers, especially old people, who are completely dependent on the sort of provision that the state used to give and for which the Labour Party in the past has fought. So in that sense, we are looking at an emptying of the whole reservoir of ability of society to resist.
Yeah, so what you identify has been replicated all over Europe, the UK and France and Germany, a hollowing out of social democracy, which has shifted to the right over the last 20 or 30 years, capitulating to the right on economic issues, on neoliberalism, on the role of free market, on deregulated banks and giving big business a free rein. And
well, yeah, you in Labour.
New Labour. New Labour is a travesty of what Labour was founded to represent. It was a mass party of the working class at the turn of the 20th century. And so what we're seeing is, let's move on to the issue of economics, because that is key to what's going on in terms of the political arena. We've seen this capitulation, as I said, of social democracy, and under the weight of the economic crash of 2008, centre ground has collapsed, vacating space, which is, with an absent left, we've seen the right fill that space. And it's been manna from heaven for those who are concerned with scapegoating, i.e. pointing the finger at migrants, at Muslims, at the other. And so now we're seeing multiculturalism itself under attack. Now, this is a very worrying development for a number of reasons. First of all, I mentioned the comparison with the 1930s. Now, historical comparisons can never be completely symmetrical, obviously, but I do see a worrying trend here where, I mean, this, some of the politics that we are seeing achieve mainstream prominence today only would ever have existed on the margins 20 years ago, even 10 years ago. So, I mean, we've got the French elections coming up. Where do you see this going? Do you agree with me, or do you think I'm overstating the fact that this could be a marker, an end to this rising tide of right-wing populism, or you don't think so? You think that momentum is still ongoing with regard to the populist right in the context of Marine Le Pen? She is also riding high in the polls, so you will be aware.
Well, of course, they are all, let us say, racist and profiting from xenophobia and encouraging it, etc. Yeah. But that is where the similarities end. Don't forget that Wilders is a split off from the mainstream Liberal Party. He was an MP for many years for the mainstream Liberal Party. And his anti-Islam point of view was developed out of love for Israel. He has very strange opinions in that area. Now, Marine Le Pen, of course, comes from a totally different stock because her father was a famous anti-Semite.
Oh, so this this is a strange convergence we're seeing take place then on the right.
Yeah, but it's very superficial because, of course, they appear on photos, etc. But whereas Wilders has a radical neoliberal program, so he's in favor of austerity, he hasn't taken one step to accept the occasional statement about lowering the pension age, etc., but never doing anything in practice. Marine Le Pen has a totally different program, which is much more protectionist and actually very appealing, although it may be anachronistic in many ways, but appealing to sections of the working class and especially the people on the agricultural sector who are now being outcompeted by cheap labor in Germany.
Okay, let's stop there for a short break. We'll continue this discussion. I'd like to move on to the working class, actually. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this.
Hard Facts.
Welcome back to the second half of Hard Facts. I'm sitting here with Kees van der Peel. We're discussing the events in Holland where they just had a national election in which the populist far-right candidate, Geert Wilders, was defeated despite riding high in the polls. And I'm wondering if this marks a change when it comes to the momentum that had been gained by the populist far-right across Europe in recent years. Kees, you mentioned the working class prior to the break there. This is something that I want to pin down, because the right is very opportunistically trying to champion the working class cause, or the cause of working class people, the left behind working class, in a very, very opportunistic way, certainly rhetorically. I believe in multiculturalism. It's not going anywhere. We're not going to turn the clock back to the 19th century or even to the 1960s or 1950s. And I don't think we want to. I think we have been culturally enriched by multiculturalism. And I think what's happening here is a symptom of the maldistribution of wealth and resources that's been taking place when it comes to neoliberalism over the last generation and more. As I said previously, the collapse of the economic system and austerity has created a perfect storm. And obviously people are suffering economic hardship and they're looking for someone to blame. And right-wing politicians such as Nigel Farage in the UK, Geert Wilders in the Netherlands, Marine Le Pen in France and so on, Donald Trump in the US, have been able to use that anger and confusion that comes with that anger in order to elevate themselves and to become populists in terms of their championing the working class interests. Now, the working class has changed, obviously. We've had the deindustrialization of the northern hemispheric countries, the advanced countries, the exportation of their industrial bases to the southern hemisphere, China and India and elsewhere. What we need is a government, and we need more state intervention, I would contend, rather than less. We hear a lot of talk about, you know, smaller governments, smaller taxes and so forth. That's a recipe for disaster. That contributed to the economic crash. We need more government in order to redistribute the wealth in these countries. And if you want to stop immigration, you have to stop the causes of immigration. And that means redistribution of wealth between states, not just within states. Neoliberalism, as I have said, sows inequality not only within states, but also between states. And this is where we have to come to these supranational bodies such as the EU, because the EU has contributed to this mess. It fails to understand what's happening, is locked into this neoliberal ideology, and it, even now, it shows no sign of changing anytime soon. So what they mean by working class is an indigenous working class. They don't include Muslims. They don't include migrant labour. They're just talking about their own indigenous working class. I see this as a very, very worrying trend. Your thoughts on that, please?
Well, I agree with everything you say. And I think there's a, within the EU, there's a major divide, although it's not sharp, but there's a divide between Northern Europe and Southern Europe. Because you said there was this tide of right-wing mobilization. But don't forget that a few months ago in Italy, there was the no in the referendum that led to the abdication of Prime Minister Renzi, who wanted to remove the anti-fascist elements from the Italian constitution and introduce more authoritarian elements. And that was rejected. So in Southern Europe, and you saw it also in Greece in the referendum about the Eurozone demands, in these countries, the people are aware that they themselves are part of the labor reserve, you know, the reserve army of labor. In Northern Europe, on the other hand, people still have the illusion. They are told that there's a real expectation in that respect. They still have the illusion that they can exclude the reserve army of labor, which is pushing from the global south and trying to get in. So in Northern Europe, there remains enough of the old welfare state, especially ideologically, although it's being deconstructed very fast, to allow people to be tempted to believe that we can still close the borders and then have the old type of society. In Southern Europe, they have given up that illusion, because there you have unemployment figures in 20% or more and youth unemployment figures of 50% or more. So I think there's a difference there, and that is also why something that is completely incomprehensible for many Dutch people, for instance, the people on the Greek islands are welcoming the Syrian refugees who are landing there. And the same is in Lampedusa, you know, the Italian
island. We're seeing some incredible examples of human solidarity in that regard. I mean, especially on part of the Greek people who have suffered inordinately from the Troika's austerity, harsh austerity plans.
Yes, and still they share their meager resources with the newcomers. That is something that here is much more difficult. Several times you spoke about similarities with the 1930s. I happen to be reading a book by Franz Neumann, Behemoth, about the Nazi state.
And it actually says that one of the policies of the Nazis was to ensure that the German workers had the feeling that they were profiting from closing off the German economy from the rest of the world, so that they still could have the illusion, even though they were exploited very harshly, that they still could have the illusion that it was better to be there than to be in any of the other European states. And it's exactly what's happening now. You know, but there's a lot of hatred being mobilized against the Greeks and the lazy Portuguese.
Yes,
and the
native. National stereotypes are being leveled.
Yes. And it works. You know, after the initial anger against the banks in 2008, it only took 2 years before the entire angry mood that existed among the population had been turned around and turned against the Southern Europeans, you know, with this abbreviation of the pigs and all that sort of terrible.
A classic case of blaming the victim, as it was.
Yeah,
it?
Exactly.
Moving on to the EU, I'd like to discuss, if we can, the prospects for the EU, because for the first time in decades, I think we can foresee the possibility of the EU itself disintegrating. I mean, if Marine Le Pen is elected in France, I see no future for the EU. But people forget what the EU, the philosophical foundations of the EU, it arose out of the ashes of the Second World War. The man who's credited with having the vision of the European Union, Jean Monnet, the French diplomat and businessman. I've just read his memoirs, actually. I thoroughly recommend anyone listening to read those memoirs. But he said he saw the EU as a guarantor of peace in Europe. We're talking about two world wars in half a century. And he said, and I quote, just after the Second World War, there will be no peace in Europe if the states rebuild themselves on the basis of national sovereignty, with its implications of prestige politics and economic protection. He went on to say, the sovereign nations of the past can no longer solve the problems of the present. They cannot ensure their own progress or control their own future. Now, your thoughts on that vision and on the EU itself, because I do think philosophically the EU is a noble concept. And I do worry because, as history shows, a divided Europe is a Europe at war. What's your thoughts on the future of the EU? I mean, surely it must survive.
Yeah, but of course not in this form and certainly not with these policies. If you don't mind, I would slightly disagree with your characterization of Monnet. It is true that a united Europe has always been a left ideal, whether you think of social democracy, Lenin and Trotsky, they all wrote about a future of Europe without war and without all these small states competing with each other. But Monnet was a businessman, you know. He was an investment banker in the 1930s. And his main concern was that if Germany, West Germany, would resurrect itself as the bulwark of heavy industry in the Cold War, then France and Germany would again be brought into on a collision course. So it's a bit less idealistic than the quote that you read suggests, but I hope you don't mind that I slightly disagree here, because it's actually dangerous to suggest that we now have the bad EU, but let's say 20, 30 years ago, there was still a good EU. It has always been a product, in my view, of the Cold War, except that in those years, so let's say from the 1950s to the 1970s, all politics, including European integration, but also national labor relations, etc., were based on compromise. Whereas today, politics is based on attacking the weak and trying to really wring out the last drop of blood from those who are employed temporarily employed or unemployed and so on and so forth, and get all the wealth to the top. So in that sense, we've gone from doubtful to very bad. And as you say, the EU looks like collapsing. It has already collapsed in critical domains. Like, just look at what is happening in Poland, in Hungary, countries that are in fact under authoritarian government. What do you think of the Baltic countries, where fascists can demonstrate in reminiscing their feats in Second World War?
Yes, and it's interesting because the collapse or the crisis within the EU is a product of the crisis within neoliberalism. And so the EU is a product of neoliberalism. Neoliberalism is not a product of the EU, as some have tried to suggest. And a lot of people are trying to describe the character of a state on the EU. People within the EU, some would like it to become, to achieve the character of a state, but it's not a state, as it were. Its politics reflect the politics of its member states, which are neoliberal and show no sign of moving away from neoliberalism. This is the problem, you see. This is economic in nature. And interesting about the Baltic states, because I want to look at, quickly, we're running out of time, unfortunately, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the demise of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s had huge ramifications for the anti-capitalist left. And now we see liberals being labelled left. I don't think these are left-wing. I think we're seeing a semantic sleight of hand on part of the far right, because they're trying to make out that they're reasonable in comparison to liberal. If they're left, then we're right, other than far right. The kind of Europe that I advocate, I do advocate a united Europe, but that would have to include Russia in a greater Europe, which is what Russian President Vladimir Putin advocated when he first came to power in Russia 15 years ago, a greater Europe. There is no ideological reason why Russia has been isolated today. It is not a communist country anymore. It's a capitalist country. So what do you see with regards to that relationship? Because I think that's key to the survival of Europe. We cannot have any kind of European Union that does not include Russia. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, I agree. Although, you know, in the end, you will always be left with the question, where should Europe end then? I mean, don't we run the risk that a united Europe with Russia would then, for instance, become a competitor with China? So I prefer the United Nations route to the European route. But otherwise, you're right. You know, you and I can fantasize about how a better Europe would look like, what it would look like, and so on and so forth. But you started with saying the left has evaporated and there has to be a force, a social force, that is strong enough to force a change of course. And that is exactly what we're missing. Only if there's a resurrection of the power of the trade unions and some political form that's associated with it, we can't expect that the bureaucrats in Brussels will, out of pure goodwill, decide to change course. Also, I think that the new Cold War with Russia is so important for keeping American power present in Europe.
The military-industrial complex.
Oh, yes.
Case, we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. Thank you very much for coming on the show. And most of all, thank you out there for listening. Until next time, remember, yes, you guessed it, the only facts worth taking seriously are hard facts.